from uptown, you know my sound is major. I know you like the lyrics, kid, so just do me your favor. Tell the tech to turn my dad up. This is a fat cut, hey, I don't back up. Because I wanna dive in and swim in the mentals where your thoughts roam. I wanna make your dome my home before you never be alone. But when you hear my song, sing along with the rhythm. Cause I got big and fat beats that I give them. Yes, it's the ears, and I'm checking out the blonde one. Maybe I can have one, maybe I can con one. Chill, I'm one with God, brothers, it's hard to stay straight until you're scared straight, and then you can't wait to get out. Then you shout, damn, I got freedom.
Have you been overcome with an irresistible urge to wash your potato? Have you looked out at the world and you're trying to figure out what the hell is going on? Well, you are at the right place with Tom and Ramon and the 100th Monkey Radio. So, Ramon, how is it going over there after 11-11-11 has come and passed? Have you, what did you do on 11-11, Ramon?
Well, I taught preschool that day, and I was able to talk to some of the kids about it briefly. It's kind of hard to explain it in Japanese or try to explain to them in English. But other than that, I did several hours of meditation, not at the same time, but separate times. And the only kind of visions I saw were more of, it's almost like seeing the universe or stars. It looked like a lot of little bright lights, so I'm just assuming that's what it was in a spiral that I was looking at. How about you, Tom? I think yours is more exciting than mine.
Well, I don't know about exciting, but it was definitely interesting. Elizabeth and I came down here to East SETI yesterday afternoon, so we weren't here for the 11-11 in the morning, but we got here and, oh my God, what a beautiful, just calming, casual feel to this place this weekend. It has probably been one of the most relaxing times I've ever set foot on this property. You know, normally I come over here and the energy is just so wild and crazy and dynamic and just moving constantly and everywhere. But yesterday it just seemed like there was a blanket that was just going, calm down, people. Calm down. And I attribute that 100% to all the meditations that are going on around the world. That calming effect, that calming feeling, that thread. And I started feeling that yesterday morning. And I started feeling it at like 8 o'clock in the morning. I had this vibration that came at the back of my head, and it wrapped around the sides of my head and came to my third eye, and it felt like it was just projecting out of my third eye, and it was just the most calming. That's the best way to describe it. It was a very, very recognizable energy flow for me. So anyways, it was good, and we spent the evening here doing some Chinese tea ceremonies and drinking some tea and having some fantastic conversation. And then we did some meditation in the evening, and yeah, it was just a really, really pleasant day. So
yeah.
I haven't really looked out at the world, you know, checked up to see if anything of any drama has occurred, but I sense that there hasn't been much going on. It's been pretty calm.
The only thing I find different is I find it easier to move energy throughout my body, I think. Or maybe it's just my mind, but whatever it is, but I just find it easier to move energy.
Yeah. It was a very interesting day for us, and I'm patiently watching the world to be able to see some tangible results, and I know that they've already been there. And whether or not you can directly attribute what we see that's going to be happening in the next in our future to things like this meditation, there's probably not going to be any tangible empirical proof that says this did that. But I have a feeling that we have turned some corners and that changes afoot. So anyways, tonight on the show we have a remarkable man who is author of several different books, and his most recent Ramon and I got a hold of, and kind of to set the stage here, I want to read a poem that I wrote back in 1991 that when I read this book, I was
before
like,
you go into that, Tom, just want to mention really quick. Want to say thank you to all our new subscribers and those of you who haven't become a subscriber yet. Suggest you do. It helps support the show and to bring you more stuff.
Absolutely.
So, Tom, take it away.
Yes, thank you, everybody. So. Okay, so I wanted to read this poem that I wrote back in 91 that I think kind of sets the stage for at least the theme of this book, not necessarily everything that this man brings to the table. He's got quite a few different levels to him that we are going to probe tonight. But anyways, the name of this poem is Vampire. In this walk of life, we sometimes find white is black and brown is green. Things are not always as they seem. Some people deceive without knowing. They do as they feel is right. I see the one for who they fight. He's no one beast, he's no one thing. He's the spirit of evil that carries a sting. A way to show them and make them see who's been controlling them and what's his fee. I seek a way to save their lives, to open their eyes to reality. The deceit, the destruction, the greed on which he feeds. What is a vampire? Who will see? He sucks the life from you and me. It's not the blood within our veins. It's the love, the will, the desire for peace. We rob ourselves of eternal life as soon as we stick out our neck. I know that vampire's name. Do you? So I would like to welcome Paul Levy to the show. Paul, how are you tonight?
I'm great. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So this this new book you just are releasing called Wetiko. Well, actually, let's step back a second. Paul, would you tell us a little bit about yourself? What brought you into this field of researching and trying to figure out what life is?
Yeah, that's my pleasure. I basically I'm an only child, and it wound up that my father was a psychopath. Was a genuine. You know, he was not diagnosed, but he was a real this world-class psychopath. And being the only child, I was the recipient of, you know, this energetic abuse. It's just kind of hard to describe with words. And it created incredible, like, this suffering in me, which really was the incentive for me to go inwards, to start contemplating what was happening because I was in so much pain. And, you know, I'm talking 30 years ago. This is actually even a little bit more than that. And because of that, I actually went so inwards that I had this awakening. And the awakening was so overwhelming that it almost killed me in the sense that I unwittingly had tapped into to this energy. It was sort of like a 75-watt bulb all of a sudden tapping into like a trillion watts of energy. Hmm. And so we're talking in 1981 – during that first year, between 81 and 82, probably, I don't know, I'm guessing like maybe four or five times, I got thrown in mental hospitals and told I had a mental illness and I would have it for the rest of my life. And that was totally a shock to me because the experience that I was having from inside myself was I was having the realization that we were having this mass shared dream and that I was beginning to wake up in. And, of course, as I was trying to articulate that and as I was trying to point out that, oh, by the way, my father's an abuser, what began happening was most interesting because the field, you know, not only my mother and the relatives and my friends, but also the mental health system, they all configured so as to protect the abuser. And then I became the identified patient. And, you know, I didn't know it at the time, but the whole thing was like this initiation where something like the non-local field that I write about in my work was actually being shown to me through what I was going through. And so, you know, without going into the story very much, to make a long story short, I as quickly as I could, I got out of the whole psychiatric community, which I saw to be unbelievably toxic and actually completely insane. And I was fortunate in that I was able to meet my teachers, some of the greatest, you know, teachers from Tibet and Burma, who I, you know, I've become very close with over the years and you know, have been a real, you know, have just done Buddhist practice very, very intensively. But it was quite an ordeal. I mean, it totally destroyed my family. My parents both died in the last, like, 12 years, completely convinced that their only child, me, is mentally ill. And I would be, like, at that point in private practice and in books and writing articles and giving lectures, and I would be sharing that with my parents and my, like, I think of, like, with my mother. On her deathbed, she reflected to me, "Paul, that's all your hallucination that you're doing that," because she was so identified with that, you know, the point of view that I was crazy, because if she, you know, stepped out of that perspective and actually tried to hear what I was saying, I was pointing at that her husband was a psychopath, which, you know, she couldn't quite deal with. So it had a real, like, a sad aspect to it, in that both my parents died convinced that I'm crazy, and I've had to deal with that, because you know how we all internalize our parents in our head.
Right.
I was fortunate to be able to unfold that awakening process, and then, you know, it took me over a decade of healing and just being in total trauma from what had played out. But then at a certain point, I had the realization, oh, well, I've discovered something. I have something to offer people. And that's when I began to teach. And that was probably 17, 18 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's not an ordinary, it's not like I studied this stuff in school, you know, and like went to a career counselor and they said, oh, you should, you know, study awakening in the dream. It just kind of really, in an organic way, crystallized out of my inner process.
Yeah, so Ramon and I talk about occasionally the proverbial 2x4 upside the head to wake people up.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It was intense. Yeah. I mean, it was so intense that, you know, I mean, I had a, you know, right before, a couple years before the awakening, with the worst of the episodes of abuse, the next day I woke up with a fever, and I had the fever for a year. And they couldn't find anything physically wrong with me. And it was just an expression that, you know, that my whole, like, mind-body had been so, like, traumatized by what had been playing out with my father. And from that point on, I was never the same.
Wow.
Yeah. So, with Tico, would you enlighten our listeners on what the word actually means? And
well, it's this Native American term, and it actually you know, has to do with cannibal sickness or with, like, people who are taken over and become an instrument for evil, for an evil spirit. And I had actually written a book about it and called it by a different name because I wasn't really familiar with it at that point. I mean, I'd heard about it, but I didn't really have anything on it to really study it in depth. So I had first called it malignant egophrenia, and or ME disease, me disease, because it's this misidentification of who we are. And it's you know, it's a profound thing. The indigenous, I mean, it was really great for me when I discovered, oh, well, what I've been tracking and naming, calling malignant egophrenia, the indigenous people, they've known about for centuries, and they've been tracking it and all that. So, you know, it's because of that that I wrote the book on Watiko. And it's this non-local, it's a psycho-spiritual disease of the soul, and it explicates itself in a non-local way, which means it operates through the field of consciousness. And what that also means is that it operates through our psyche. So, I mean, it's an incredibly amazing thing to get turned on to, because we're all experiencing it, either in our relationships or in our own heads or in the greater body politic.
All right. So, you know, I saw a close parallel between with Tico, this whole scenario, and the whole archonic theories. Are you familiar with
that? Oh, totally, totally. It's exactly what the archons, you know, in the Gnostics, what they were pointing at, because it's like this mind parasite that actually will insinuate thoughts into your head. It's like you have a tapeworm or a parasite like a parasite that actually, you know, or like a tapeworm that gets into you, into your system, because, you know, the immune system isn't strong enough. And then it will insinuate thoughts into your head in so that you'll actually, you know, feed, you'll feed, you're thinking you're feeding yourself, but you're actually feeding the parasite, and you're the host for it, and then it just continues to grow like a tapeworm does in your system until it kills you, and then it has to find another host. But the thing about it, it doesn't want to kill you too soon, or else, you know, then it would just be evicted and have to find some other place. So, it's very much like that, and it shapeshifts. see, it's the shape-shifting bug that will shape-shift and take your form and put you on. Put you on meaning not only fooling you, but it'll put you on as a disguise. It'll assume your form, so you'll identify with it, and then you'll act it out, thinking you're acting out what you're wanting to do, but you're actually the instrument through which the virus, the parasite, the tapeworm, the vampire, whatever you want to call it, Watiko is one, you know, is the name for it, the indigenous people would use, then all of a sudden you are like compulsively acting out the, you know, the very whatever behavior is feeding it, and actually it's a form of suicide because it's destroying you. And it not only happens within a person, like individually, but it's happening collectively. It's what's actually happening throughout our greater body politic. And the thing about when you have a phenomenon like a vampire, the one thing it can't stand is to be seen. Because when you add the light of consciousness and when you see it, so it'll continually obfuscate and hide itself. Because when you see it, you take away its power and its autonomy. So the whole cure for the actual disease is when you have enough people who see it. And it's actually very much like being in a dream, and when you have enough people who are awakening in the dream who see the nature of the situation they're in, i.e. that they're dreaming, and they can connect with each other, and they can actually like create a container filled with their, you know, with consciousness through which they can change the dream.
Right. Right. That's kind of what there is a large element of society right now. Well, I won't say large yet, but there is an element in society, and I tend to believe that people like you, me, Ramon, and many of our listeners are amongst this group who have become conscious and are doing what they can to contain this virus, if you want.
It's definitely a virus in the sense that the thing about a virus has, you know, this energy that needs to, like, sort of like it wants to replicate itself, to propagate itself, but it can't do that on its own. So it needs some other form of life to plug into so that then it'll be, you know, that other life form will be in a way the birthing chamber through which the virus replicates itself. And but the thing about Watiko, it actually is doing the propagation of itself through the unconscious. So you know, if we even have the thought form of, oh, I understand Watiko, I see Watiko, I get it, you're right there, you're susceptible to falling under its thrall, because we always have, you know, the possibility of falling asleep and falling into self-deception. So it's because of that, you know, one of the ways of really protecting oneself against Watiko is to really develop like some sort of a mindfulness practice. We are continually, and then when you're seeing, for example, one of the way, because it's a non-local disease, that means it's actually happening both in the psyche and outside of the world at the same time. And so it's easy to see it outside in the world, you know, oh yeah, you know, the banksters or whatever, and to see the evil out there. But it's impossible to see Watiko and to see the evil of Watiko in the outside world and not be triggered internally, because it's non-local. It touches someplace deep inside of ourselves. So one of the ways of dealing with it, or like a primary way of dealing with it, is not to so much focus on outside, but to then self-reflectively speculate upon, well, what in me just got triggered as I'm seeing the evil outside of myself. And then you're able to metabolize your own darkness. And once you do that, you non-locally talk about the 100th monkey phenomena. You actually, that like expansion of consciousness or that integration of your shadow actually influences the non-local field and influences the whole entire collective unconscious of our species.
All right. So many people, that's how so many of these different spiritual teachers, that's what they point at, is addressing inside first, you know, fix yourself, fix what's in you first, and then the world takes care of itself.
Yeah. But that's true. But it needs to be complemented. You know, in my first book, I talk about becoming a spiritually informed political activist, and what that means that you have to really co-join or cross-pollinate being, you know, a political activist, politically active, and a spiritual practitioner. So the point is that, you know, there are some people I know, there are some people who really their calling is to be sitting in meditation or going into retreat for the rest of their lives. And if they're not, you know, turning away from a part of themselves. If that's their true calling, great. But there are definitely spiritual people, and I know some, who in their spiritual practice, they're actually avoiding relationship with a part of themselves. So the point is to actually combine your spiritual practice with being, you know, with being participatory in the political arena. And to say it even differently, because this is a dream, and I want to talk about it at a certain point that you can't even see Watika without having the realization that we're having a Mashiach dream. One of the ways of understanding that is that our inner process, the inner psychological process deep inside of us, is actually materializing in, as, and through the outer world, exactly like a dream is. Because think about it, what you're inside of a dream, what is the dream but your inner process just projected out as the dreamscape? That's exactly the nature of our situation. And what that means is that if you want to do real inner work on your inner self, yeah, you look within, and at the same time, your inner process is manifesting as the outside world.
Right.
You know, so to fully participate in the greater body politic.
Got to have one foot in both worlds.
Right, right, exactly. And so I've coined the term a spiritually informed political activist to name that.
With that being said, can we go into your dreams?
Sure.
The first one in the beginning of the book, and then the second one when you're laying next to it.
Yeah, please, whatever.
Yeah, so
you want me to tell the dream, or do you want to share because you read it? And
no, I'd rather you tell the dream because it's your dream.
Sure,
I have plenty of my own.
I thought it was your dream. Okay, yeah. Well, in the book, I tell a few dreams in the intro, and there are actually three dreams I tell, and they're all very similar. In that, in the first dream, I'm with Dracula. And, you know, we're just hanging out and we're very friendly. And then I have the recognition, his eyes start glowing, sort of like glowing in the dark type of thing. And I realize, oh my God, he's like this supernatural, he's like a vampire. You know, I really get that I'm in danger. And very interestingly, I don't even think about what to say or do. I just start making these animal noises, like just booing, not booing, mooing and barking and you know, just squawking and squealing, just like animals do when they around an energy that they don't recognize. And he doesn't like that because he knows that I'm onto him then. And then I just leave. I just, you know, get my backpack and go because I realize I'm in danger. And so one commentary that I make in the book about that one, that dream, is that, you know, sort of like I think of like with mythology or with fairy tales, when you're, you know, confronting an evil demon or a monster or a dragon or a witch or something like that, you have to have a strong enough sense of self in order to have it out with them. And if you don't, the real smart thing is to just run away. And at that point in my evolution, I mean, if I would have confronted the vampire and had it out with him, I would have been destroyed. So, you know, me in the dream just getting out of there, that was the right thing to do. Then, okay, now this other dream I tell before I get to the major one. This other dream I had a long time ago when I had it the morning that two of my spiritual teachers were coming from Tibet, and they were, you know, I was picking them up at the airport that morning. So it was a very, you know, kind of auspicious morning. And the dream was that me and a group of people, we were trying to find Dracula. And we were actually in the dream, we were chanting Bela Lugosi, Bela Lugosi. And then I see it, but nobody can find Dracula. And then I see him, and I try to point him out to everybody else, and no one else can see him. I'm the only one who can. So that's the second dream. And then in the final dream that I share in the book, the intro, is that I'm actually in bed with Dracula. And I totally know he's an evil vampire, and I totally know what he wants. He wants me, and it's a battle of wills. And I know I just have to make it through the night till dawn, but my God, it's going to be a long night. And then I just have this thought, I'm going to do my practice because I'm a very serious Tibetan Buddhist practitioner. And I start chanting the mantra of Padmasambhava, and Padmasambhava is an exorcist. So I just start chanting that particular mantra, and I'm like literally shaking in my boots. In the dream, and I'm actually chanting it out loud because I woke up my partner next to me, and she then, after I got up from the dream, she said to me, oh my God, you sounded terrified. What was happening? So, and that was my subjective experience in the dream as I was chanting the mantra. And then at a certain point, it transformed from the Padmasambhava mantra to Om Mani Padme Hum, which is the mantra of compassion. Because at that point, I began to realize that I was just having a dream, and that this Dracula figure was just that part of me. And that Om Mani Padme Hum, that's what I do whenever I'm in a dream and realize that I'm actually in a dream. That's the practice I do, because in Buddhism they say the expression of real awakening is always the co-joining of two factors, emptiness, which is lucidity, and compassion. And Om Mani Padme Hum is the mantra of compassion.
Well, through all those dreams, I see your progressive understanding and awakening of yourself to what's going on behind the scenes in our world. And then your ability to stand sovereign within it.
Oh, totally. Oh, yeah. I mean, if I didn't, you know, when I got out of the last hospital, this was in 82, you know, it was then that I began really having the most mind-blowing dreams every night. And it was like, because I was in deep trouble. Here I had been diagnosed and solidified and pathologized and, you know, I mean, and my unconscious came to my aid by, you know, sending me these dreams every night. So if I didn't connect with my dreams, you know, I would have been a goner, you know, type of thing. So, yeah, I really can't, you know, say enough to how important it is for people to connect with not only their dreams at night, but I'm actually talking about to see their, you know, the actual waking life as a dream. That's really what my work is about, is trying to really introduce people to that experience.
Yeah, ever since I quote unquote woke up or began the wake up process, it's been like walking through a complete dream for me. I mean, I see reflection of myself all over the place, and at first I thought for sure I had my cheese had slipped completely off its cracker. I thought my elevator didn't quite go to the top floor type thing. It was
Sure.
I very seriously questioned my own sanity. I mean, I was like, this shit's just way too weird to be real. And
Yeah, totally. Well, that's exactly what happened for me. Like, and that's you know, typical. Or yeah, that's typical for people who are having a spiritual emergence, because your psyche is melting down. It's like deconstructing. It's like disintegrating. So that you can reintegrate it in a higher, more coherent way. And, you know, a lot of indigenous cultures would understand when somebody's, you know, acting a little bit funny or crazy or abnormal, that they might be having a spiritual awakening, that they might actually be called to be some sort of shaman or healer. But it's very unfortunate that our modern day Western culture, they're just, you know, psychiatrists are just trained to pathologize. So here, you know, because of the abuse from my father, and typically there's a correlation between abuse or trauma or wounding and spiritual awakening. It's almost like getting wounded in a way starts the deeper archetypal process of potentially like the shamanic initiation. But our culture just has so little understanding of when somebody's acting kind of in an abnormal way. They're, like I was saying, they're just totally trained to pathologize. And for me, they like locked me up, they medicated me, they diagnosed me. You know, I mean, it was incredible. It was so, you know, I'm still 30 years later, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around just what happened and just the incredible, like, trauma of it and abuse of it. And that, you know, I'm one of the fortunate ones in that I was able to escape from that matrix.
Right.
I
was just going to ask how many people are sitting in psych wards right now that have the potential to be absolutely amazing shaman or healers or intuitives or people that had bring truth to the world. You know, how many are sitting in there totally medicated out so damn far that they can't even think?
Yeah, I know. Totally. It's tragic. But that's the question, because there's definitely, you know, who's to say how many, but there's definitely, I would say, a large number of people. You know, and understand, as you guys do, when somebody goes through that process and they actually come out the other side, you know, typically they have incredible, like, these gifts for the tribe, for the community, for the world.
It's really, really amazing with that, because I've I've experienced, you know, as you know, Paul, taking the train in New York City, you meet a lot of these people that are heavily medicated, and some of them, if you stop and you listen to, you know, they're quote unquote crazy, quote unquote homeless, and you stop and you listen to some of the things they're saying. There was one time there was this man and he was just cursing on what was it, Times Square, inside the train station. And everybody walking by, he was cursing at them and saying things. And if you stopped and you listened to what he was saying, he was pointing things out on people, but it sounded more like he knew what he was saying to them. Like he psychically was picking up things on people and spitting it back out to them. So
yeah, yeah,
whatever evil he was saying, he was spitting back out to them. And I mean, I've had so many experiences like that with those kind of people. They're looking at you and they look crazy, but you can tell they're looking deeper than what the normal person can see.
Yeah, and like one way of understanding. Sure, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, I was just going to say that the one thing that brings up for me is like, you know, I mean, even like, you know, think about in a family system, and particularly with little kids, like kids are like shamans in that they're totally sensitive and they pick up the unconscious in the field and they'll act it out like a shaman does, right? So like these people you're describing, a lot of them are so, you know, empathic and sensitive, and they'll actually pick up there's certain like a role that's not embodied in the field. If somebody's like, you know, disassociated from a part of their unconscious, people who are sensitive will actually pick up that energy and embody it and play it out and give voice to it and have it inform what they're doing. But like a shaman is able to, you know, and well, the thing I'm describing is what a shaman does, but a shaman is able to do that, and they have a container in their own psyche, and the community is like conjuring them up to play the role of the shaman. So there's there's a container in the community to unfold what's coming through the shamanic personality. But when somebody who's very shamanic, like maybe these people you're describing on the trains, when they're doing it, they're not doing it in any sort of container. And of course, then people maybe get afraid and then pathologize them or solidify them, you know. And so it's not here. They could be potentially shamans who are actually these conduits for the marginalized voice, for the disassociated energies that are like in the unconscious of the field. But yet, not being recognized, they just become sort of, you know, people kind of react in fear against them.
Do you think there's a conscious element out there somewhere near the top of the quote-unquote pyramid that is fully aware of what's going on, that actively works to propagate this virus?
Well, it's an interesting question because, you know, people who are, I mean, there are all these different degrees of Watiko. There are people who are just, you know, really well-intentioned, who are, like, even I think about people who are some well-intentioned people supporting Bush, not recognizing that Bush was totally taken over in the incarnation in human form of Watiko. And then by, like, them supporting Bush, they're unwittingly being the non-local agents, which helps the virus to propagate itself. Then in distinction to that, there are people, you know, whether it's Bush or even people above him, and your question is a good one. It's like, yeah, are there people who are purposefully, you know, propagating the virus? And the thing, you know, which is so interesting, because when somebody is possessed by Watiko, part of the nature of the disease is you don't know you're possessed by it, okay, or you wouldn't be possessed. And so one of the images that I'll use in my book, it's like when Toto in, like, The Wizard of Oz, when he pulls the curtain, you know, back, and there's the wizard. It's sort of like if he pulled the curtain back, and instead of there being an actual man who's like manipulating stuff, there's just the formless archetype. So in other words, what I'm pointing at is that even the people at the top of the pyramid, they themselves are just instruments for the formless archetype of evil to actually materialize itself into the third dimension. Okay, and I think that's a really important, you know, thing to understand, because a lot of people, and the thing is, I'm not saying that there aren't people who are like, you know, kind of incredible conduits for evil and should be prosecuted and put away. No, I'm saying absolutely, they're responsible for their incredible criminal actions. But I'm saying that even they are just merely instruments of, you know, in the Bible they talk about principalities and powers, you know, these transpersonal energies that are animating the particular human instruments who then, you know, are the ones who play out the stuff in the world, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Do you find that we ourselves are the creators of this Wetiko? Like,
Totally.
Because our thought form creates things. So
through
our thought form, you know, maybe way back, who knows when, somebody was thinking in this way and they themselves were sucking other people's energies.
Yeah, because the archonic, in the archonic mythologies, the way John Lamb Lash has put the Sophianic mythologies back together, reconstructed it.
Mm-hmm.
The Archon, which would parallel the Wetiko, is a byproduct of the creation, of one of the original byproducts of the creation of Earth and Sophia.
Yeah. No, you're totally onto it. And I just want to say, I really appreciate his work, the whole, like, you know, the thing he's doing with the Gnosticism, John Lash's work. I just want to be on record as saying that I think people should really pay attention to what he's doing. And so the thing about the question about, oh, are we creating it? That's like such a great question, because what I try to point out again and again is that we're all dreaming up Wetiko together, that it's a dreaming phenomena, that you can't understand Wetiko without having the realization that this whole, the universe is a mass shared dream. And so we, in the same way in my book on Bush, I was pointing out, oh, we're having a mass shared dream, so who is Bush? We've dreamed him up. He's our dream character. He's the part of ourselves that we've dreamed up into materialization, into incarnation, but at the same time, he's the revelation of this transpersonal disease, if we actually have the eyes to see that. So in the same way, yeah, it's not like there's any objective virus at all that's like, oh, gonna, you know, kill us. It's like, no, the origin is our own mind. It's our own dreaming power that's doing that. And the thing which is even trippier, if I may, is that encoded in Wetiko is like this incredible gift, because it potentially is waking us up.
So in other words, Wetiko is basically an expression, the dark expression of ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. It's like if you think about the self has a light and a dark, you know, sort of, you know, the light and dark aspects. And the thing about Wetiko, so it doesn't actually exist in an objective way, because you can't, in Buddhism it's called emptiness. It is no intrinsic independent existence separate from the mind that's observing it. And yet it can destroy our species. So it's pointing at the incredible power that is inherent in all of us. But it's that, you know, like I was trying to say, encoded in it is, so it's manifesting in as sort of like as this, you know, this incredibly dark demonic energy. But encoded in it, the word demonic comes from daimonic, and the daimonic is—it's not just a negative energy. It's the guiding spirit. It's the inner voice, and implicit in the daimonic is the creative spirit. So the thing about Wetiko is that it's potentially showing us our own dreaming power. It's potentially revealing to us that we're having a dream. It's actually showing us the profound importance of the psyche. Because its origin is in the psyche, and it, you know, apart from the psyche, it doesn't exist. So it's actually potentially introducing us to the reality of the psyche. So encoded in Wetiko is an incredible blessing. It's like in quantum physics, they'll talk about, you know, is light a wave or a particle? Well, it depends how you observe it. It's actually both. Well, the same thing with Wetiko. It's like the deepest, darkest evil co-joined with the highest divinity in one entity.
Right, right.
So do you find that so for example, when we were giving into our fears, I'm trying to remember what movies, but a lot of those science fictions or animes would have a point where the person is creating their fears, so their worst fears are becoming alive, and then they're saying you have to clear your mind, and then it changes, the big monster loses the power.
Right.
So with our fears, we're feeding this and making it stronger.
Exactly. It feeds on our fear. That's exactly the energy. And keep in mind that fear is an expression of the separate self, that when we're identified with an imagination that we exist separately from the rest of the universe and from each other, one of the, or the expression of that identity pattern of feeling separate is fear. So to the extent that we actually invest our energy in fear, we're actually cultivating and feeding Watiko.
It reminds me of, did you ever watch all of Star Wars, episode 1 to 6?
No, I don't think I saw all of them.
Well, I'll give a brief overview. So basically what's his name? The Master Sith, is it? Do you remember his name, Tom? Darth Vader's master?
Yeah, whatever. I don't remember what his name was. Darth Maul? No, Darth Maul was the other guy.
Anyway, he's the guy with the hood, very ugly face. And what I noticed, the analogy that I'm using from this movie is that he is constantly manipulating everything. So in the beginning episodes, he is the both sides. He's the separatist movement, and he's also the Empire. So he's making both these groups of people fight each other. And he's feeding off that anger and fear. And the first thing he does in order to, when he was doing with Anakin, which then later becomes Darth Vader, he feeds on his fear. He says, well, if you don't want your wife to die, I can teach you how to do this. And he starts feeding on his fear because his fear is that his wife is going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So he feeds on that fear and he empowers that fear. And that's how he's able to turn them into the quote-unquote dark side. And then later in the other movie, he tries to do the same thing to Luke. But Luke recognizes and says, I am not going to become part of this.
Right, right. Totally. Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, it makes me – what you're just saying makes me think you know, one of the things that I'm continually contemplating in the book is trying to shed light on evil. Because, like, you know, the evil of Watiko, or just archetypal evil in general, because if you don't really see it, like, you know, there are spiritual, like, New Agey people who say, oh, evil doesn't exist, I don't want to give it any energy. Well, by it's one thing if they really understand what they're doing, but if they're actually contracting against it out of fear, if they're avoiding evil because they're afraid to give it energy, they're unwittingly feeding it by actually their contraction. You know,
right,
it's interesting. In town here, there's like the big New Age bookstore, which will go nameless, in that I've been teaching there for years, you know, giving a couple of lectures a year for like close to 20 years. And, you know, they all know me. And then my new book came out on Watiko, and they were like setting up a book signing. And then, you know, I gave them a copy of the book, and then they began to read it. And they called me up or emailed me and they said, oh, first off, we're not going to carry your book, and second off, your book signing, we're canceling it. And why they're canceling it, because in their mind, it's like, oh, you're just talking too much about evil. And it made me laugh because, yeah, they're just, you know, the typical New Age metaphysical bookstore that's overly identified with the light, and here somebody is actually trying to flood light on evil so as to take away its power, but they're, like, so freaked out by that. So, you know, it was just kind of a funny little anecdote for me. But I, you know, and they said I could still give the talk. I just wasn't allowed to talk about Watiko, which was so bizarre. And so I decided, okay, I'll still do that. And so the whole talk I just gave was based on how if we're actually turning away from evil, from facing the dark, from taking a look at the shadow, we're unwittingly feeding it by our contraction against it, by our fear. Okay. And just going back to that dream, that third dream, it was like when I found myself, I was in bed with this evil vampire. And first off, being in bed, it was clear, well, I'm complicit with this energy in some way. But also, you know, by all of a sudden calling in Padmasambhava the exorcist, I was calling out the demon. I was actually truly dealing with it. I was looking at it. I was coming to terms with it. Instead, where in the first dream, I just needed to run away because I wasn't ready yet. You know, so there are all these stages that you go through, I think, in one's evolution.
Yeah, I see that looking out at the New Age communities, there is a very heavy community out there that, that does refuse to acknowledge the quote-unquote dark side. And what they don't realize that is that the – well, at least I won't put it that way. What I see, my personal opinion and what I have learned and experienced is that the way to get through all this is the center path, is to be able to acknowledge both sides and to see both sides. Even in going into the Judeo-Christian stuff, you know, this goes right into the purest sense of judgment. Judge not, lest you be judged. Okay, well, if you are far right on the fluffy, fluffy, good side of it, then and you completely block out the negative side, then you are judging yourself to be better than that negative side. You have put yourself above that negative side. Instead of acknowledging it as being the balance, the counterbalance to who and what we are, to be able to see both, you know, yes, I have both light, yeah, dark side. And the way for me to be able to navigate through this life and this experience that we're having in this as you called it, the dream world, to be able to get the most out of this experience in this dream world, I have to be able to juggle both of those sides. And if I'm blocking one of those sides out, that's the one that's going to blindside me and knock me off the path. That's totally the way I see it anyways.
Yeah, that's totally right on. I mean, you know, just from the psychological point of view, what's underlying Watiko is like when people shadow project and they actually disassociate from their own evil, from their own darkness, and project it outside of themselves, and then they try to destroy the other, whoever's embodying and the recipient of their shadow, you know, without having the realization that, oh, then they've become possessed by the very darkness that they're projecting out. And so, but we, as like good intentioned, you know, progressive people, we have to be careful of that too, because say if we see, you know, like with the Wall Street bankers, and so, yeah, so they're actually, they've split off from their own darkness and projecting it onto whoever, you know, whether it be, you know, whatever, Muslims or poor people or the 99% or whatever it is. So if we then concretize them as being evil, then we're guilty, you know, when you get right down to it, of the very same psychological dynamic that we're accusing them of. And so then we fall into the trap, you know.
Right.
And yeah. Go ahead, sir.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, one other way of – so the thing about shadow projection is really, you know, an incredibly important thing to understand. And one other way of understanding that is from the spiritual point of view. Here's, you know, think about Christ, who – and I'm not talking from the metaphysical aspect. I'm talking about just seen as a symbol that kind of precipitated or crystallized out of and into the dream, this waking dream of ours, that all of our species dreamed him into incarnation. And from the symbolic point of view, so I'm not saying, oh, did he exist or didn't he exist? I'm just saying when you contemplate the fact that at least in our imagination, you know, there's this figure of Christ, and symbolically what he's showing is he's holding the tension of the opposites. He's a vessel filled with divine conflict as he's crucified, and at the same time, just like a symbol brings together opposites and brings them together. And the antonym of symbolic is diabolic, which divides. So holding the tension of the opposites that Christ is symbolically sort of representing to us, you know, and not disassociating from that darkness and projecting out the shadow, but being able to hold both the light and the shadow, that in a way creates this inner container through which you could say the resurrected body, or Jung calls it the transcendent function, or the reconciling symbol, or just an idea of grace. Something then comes through that the ego couldn't have produced by itself. That's the enlightenment that comes out of being able to hold the tension of the opposites, which is, you know, this genuine agonia. It's an agony. It's an archetypal crucifixion experience. But yet, and we're all going through it because we're all crucified with Christ in a way. It doesn't make a difference what our religion is. And so the extent that we're able to build up that inner energetic container in ourselves and not just project out the shadow, that's the very thing that then will bring some form of light into us.
It kind of reminds me growing up in the Christian tradition where my grandmother was one of those grandmas that if it didn't agree to her religious point of view, it was the devil. So if you were into dancing and going to nightclubs, then that was the devil's realm, and that's what that was a satanic ritual that you were a part of.
Well, the interesting thing, okay, there's one thing about that. Like Jung calls shadow projection, he actually defines shadow projection as the lie. And who's the liar? Just when you by association, it's the devil, you know? So it's just interesting just to associate for a second.
I was just thinking out loud that it seems the more you ignore it, the more you become part of it, and the more you fight it, the more you become part of it.
Yeah, well, that's it.
So.
It's like a conundrum. That's the thing. It's a total dilemma.
I find that a lot with people who be let me say this in the right way. People who become born again Christians, and the reason why I'm using Christianity as one example is because what I grew up in. But when they become born again, it seems like they want to go the right path, but then they become this. I don't even know the right word to say without offending anybody, but they become almost as evil themselves because they ignore those who are not Christians, and then they put their own ideas onto other people, and they push this. Just like on the other extreme, you got the really fluffy that just turned a blind eye to it and ignore it.
Well, it's like the thing you were saying is that, so with Watiko, with the evil of Watiko, if you just ignore it, then you're unwittingly, feeding it. And if you fight it, then you're feeding it. So it's a real dilemma. It's pointing at almost like that our whole paradigm of like two-valued logic where it's either yes or no or true or false, gets up into question. And in this next version of the book, I actually go into there's a higher form of logic, four-valued logic, which is really important to really understand a paradox like Watiko, And yeah, because it really it just offers us an incredible conundrum. Like a double bind. Like, what do we do? If we don't do anything, then we're feeding the demon. If we do something, we're feeding the demon. What do we do? But that dilemma is actually showing us something about its nature and our nature.
So, from your perspective, do you feel that in order to overcome this, we have to transmute this quote unquote demon, this Wetiko, this parasite? We have to transmute it because, like as we said, it's we're in a dilemma because if we fight it, we become part of it, and if we, it's to give it a better perspective. So let's say we have an evil president, and he's just really evil. So we become the rebellion to fight it. But in order to fight it, we have to become just as bad as he is. So you have to use fire in order to fight fire. So my point is, how do we transmute it? Because we can't fight it and we can't ignore it.
Well, one of the ways, and that's what I go into in my book is that there in Tibetan Buddhism there's a practice called the lion's gaze. And what it means is, like, say if you have a stick and you throw a stick with a dog, the dog runs after the stick. Now the stick is, imagine the stick symbolizing our like afflictive emotions, like we get triggered. So if somebody triggers us and we're indulging in, oh, they're the problem, if only they would stop doing that, then I would feel better. That's being like a dog who just is running after the afflictive emotion out there, like the problem is outside of ourselves. But with a lion, if you throw a stick with a lion, the lion runs after you. It doesn't bother with the stick. And so in Buddhism, they say, have the gaze of the lion. When something triggers you, say that evil president, when if that's triggering you, then by having the gaze of the lion, you then self-reflect. And in that moment, there's an opportunity for you to see what in you just got triggered. You see, that's the non-locality of evil. You can't see evil without a part of it, you know, being set aflame in your right. own psyche. And then by you seeing that and adding awareness to that, you're able to metabolize that, because the way to deal with Watiko is not through, like, creating new laws or, like, even group action. I mean, in a certain way, group action is incredibly helpful, but it, as individuals, each one of us has to actually do the work and transmute or metabolize our own darkness into our wholeness. And then we can, when we actually connect with each other in that way as a collective, that's when we actually are able to activate something. I call it, we can conspire to co-inspire. We can activate our collective genius. In my first book, I talk about we can create an art happening called Global Awakening, in which we're actually, you know, dreaming each other awake. And that's an evolutionary process which we're being invited to actually participate in. Okay.
The great apocalypse. So we are at the end of our first hour here, Paul.
Are you serious?
Yes, we are. It has gone.
Time goes faster. You're having fun, huh?
Yeah, it does. So, Paul, where can people find out more about you and pick up this book and your last book, your George Bush book?
Yeah, with all of that, they can go to my website, awakeninthedream.com, www.awakeninthedream.com, and you can find out more about me. I have like a ton of articles there. They're all for free. I just want to get the word out. And you can buy the Watiko book. You can buy the Bush book. I have another interview online.
How many books do you have?
Right now I just have two, but once the Watiko book came out, which I self-published, within 2 weeks, this major publisher contacted me. They had come across the book. They realized that it was a very important book, and they were like asking me, oh, could we, you know, would you be interested in us helping, you know, picking up the rights and publishing it, which that was the whole idea. I want to get this out more. And so they're giving – I have a deadline for like I think the 1st of February, and I'm totally – rewriting the book, making it way more fleshed out, so it's probably going to be 3 or 4 times more substantial, because I'm, instead of hyperlinking to all my previous articles, I'm actually just integrating all the best of the other articles for 20 years into the next version of the book, and then that'll be out in 2013.
Nice.
So really quick question, how did you get Sting to read the book? Is he a close friend, or just
I wouldn't say he's a close friend, but one, this was like, talk about a dream, right? A number of years ago, I get an email. I open up my computer one morning, and there's an email from Sting. And, you know, he's backstage about to give a concert somewhere overseas, and he's, you know, just telling me how much he loves my work. So, you know, he's a big fan of my work, and he reads all my articles. And, yeah, so, you know, we correspond, and, you know, I've met him a few times. And,
that's amazing.
Yeah, we're mutual fans. So I feel really appreciative that he actually supports my work.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So, okay, well, guys, I want you to stay tuned and listen to Brooks Agnew as soon as we're done here, and then pop on over to the website and jump into the members section and hear the second hour here with Paul. And we will continue to dig deeper into this. This is some fascinating stuff.
Yeah, if you haven't become a member, become a member. If you do the yearly, it's actually way less than a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
I know that gets thrown out there too much. Well, ever since Starbucks, you know, a cup of coffee is pretty expensive. So.
And we want to thank everybody who does support us, and we really do appreciate it. And hopefully this show will continue bringing you guys the information that we think is appropriate. So we love you guys. And condemnation without investigation is the height of ignorance.
And love you deny is the pain you carry.
There you go.
Have a good night.
All right. Good night.